It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine shares science headlines with us, including new birth control technology that's being developed for men. First, record levels of money are being spent by outside groups in the race for Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seat, currently held by Democrat Tammy Baldwin. As reported in the Wisconsin State Journal, a count from the Center for Responsive Politics puts the total at nearly $10 million so far. Their analysis says that's more than double the outside spending in any other Senate race in the country this cycle, and it adds up to make the race the most expensive in the nation at this point. With Baldwin the incumbent, most of the attention is on the Republican primary fight between State Senator Leah Vukmir of Brookfield and Kevin Nicholson, a management consultant from Delafield. Madison businessman Eric Hovde was considering a run on the Republic ticket, but yesterday on Upfront with Mike Goucher, he announced he will not be running.
Well, after wrestling with this decision for the last 6 months, I've decided not to run.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. She's with us now to talk about spending in this U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, it's a big midterm election year, Lily. A lot of Senate races going on around the country, but all this money coming here to Wisconsin. Why Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, Wisconsin in the recent past has shown itself to be a fairly good option for Republicans in the state races. Particularly, you saw Russ Feingold lose twice now to Ron Johnson. And I think after the Senate race in 2016, the sort of interest was on possibly getting rid of Tammy Baldwin. She's only been there for one term, so she doesn't have a long history as a senator. And I'm assuming also that there is probably some polling internals on her side and also on the Republican side showing that there may be vulnerabilities. And so, you know, early money is possibly there also to sort of, you know, beat her up, as it were, to flood the airwaves and have people start thinking about the Senate race. But this is even before you have a clear nominee for the Republican side. So there's a little triangulation going on there as well.
Before we dig deeper into who the money's going in favor of and who it's coming from, I want to put this on the national stage. There's talk that Democrats have a shot at taking the U.S. House of Representatives this year, not a slam dunk by any means, but Republicans really interested in holding on to their Senate majority. How does Wisconsin's seat play into that?
Well, Wisconsin's seat is one of the ones that the Republicans are looking at that they have to pick up if they want to potentially hold on to the Republican majority if they lose any of the other seats that may be in play, like Dean Heller in Nevada, who's been looking really vulnerable to a Democratic challenge. And then, of course, you have a couple of places where you have open seats. Bob Corker's not running again in Tennessee. And that's another place. And Jeff Flake is not running in Arizona. And Democrats are looking at those races as well because open seats are easier to capture than getting rid of an incumbent.
There's been a lot of talk about a possible blue wave, a Democratic wave in Wisconsin after the Supreme Court election last week, a special election as well. How does that all factor into this U.S. Senate race?
Well, again, some of the races that you saw earlier that have, you know, had Democrats winning were, while Rebecca Dallet did win a statewide race, it's not a national race. Mm-hmm. And so national races, which Senate races sort of figure into, become oftentimes in off-year elections, they also become referenda on the sitting president, in this case, President Trump. In the past, we saw this in 2010 with regard to Barack Obama, or 2006 with regard to George W. Bush. And so when you have a Senate race, it is also about sort of telegraphing messages around the administration.
Talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, looking at Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race. Yeah, it's early. The primary is not till August, general election November, but lots of money coming into this race. Lily, you mentioned a lot of this money coming in attacking Tammy Baldwin. Is this mostly so far outside Republican groups pouring money into the race?
That's what I understand, that there is a lot of money coming either from Republican groups or sort of Republican PAC money or money associated with people who are supporting Republican candidates. There's a lot of money going to the candidates who are running against each other for the Republican nomination. And so you have money that's coming in that's attacking Baldwin, but you also have money that's coming in that's either supporting or attacking Nicholson and Vukmir.
Yeah, let's talk about that race. Leah Vukmir, State Senator Kevin Nicholson, management consultant, veteran. This has not been a happy, huggy, kumbaya sort of race. This has gotten a little ugly pretty well in advance of the actual voting.
Yeah, and again, we're still a couple months out from the voting. It's not next month. This is a lot of money to see also this early in a primary. And one that you note is not necessarily going swimmingly. So whoever comes out of it may come out a little bit bruised.
And we're seeing a lot of the money coming from one person, really, for the candidate, Kevin Nicholson, coming from Richard Uihlein. I think it's Uihlein because he's from Illinois. It's Uihlein in Milwaukee. One right. person really putting a lot of money into that side, and then a lot of state, I don't know if you want to call them establishment Republicans, but people like Reince Priebus and state figures backing Leah Vukmir. Is it too soon to say this is kind of a Wisconsin Republican insider race versus an outsider?
Well, it's a little bit of a, it seems like a proxy race in some level, that Vukmir is a kind of Republican establishment candidate inside Wisconsin. She does have the backing of people who are, you know, considered to be part of the Republican establishment in Wisconsin. And then Nicholson is a more Donald Trump-like figure. I'm not saying he's Donald Trump-like, but, you know, he's not in an elected position, and he's coming as an outsider. And so you kind of have some of the same dynamic that you saw during the election cycle in 2016 with regard to Trump being an outsider, not holding elected office, and running against a lot of people who were supported or who were themselves establishment Republicans.
We're seeing all this money come in. What forms is this taking? Are we seeing ads, you know, traditional media, TV and radio? Is this online, a little of both?
It's a lot of both. It's a lot of television advertising and also a lot of ads online, which are also harder to necessarily keep track of. And it's also it's still unclear how much of that people absorb and sort of integrate into their thinking about candidates.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Some people question whether these kind of ads make a difference. But the notion that people keep spending millions of dollars every election time suggests that somebody thinks they matter. Do they matter?
It still is, you know, political scientists, psychologists, advertising experts are all running lots of focus groups and trying to assess how much these ads affect us. This is a lot of, obviously, the discussion about the Facebook advertising in 2016 and Cambridge Analytica and so forth. And so there's still a lot of research that's going on to try to figure out how much these ads, in fact, influence people and how much you do absorb and how much, you know, sort of you just sort of push aside as sort of noise.
We've got this race for the Senate, Lily. We've got a race for governor. Do you think one of those is going to be the premier thing that people are watching that maybe takes the air out of the room for the other races in town?
I'm not sure. I mean, and there are a lot of people running for the Democratic nomination for governor, too. So you've got sort of a lot of different things going on. They're both statewide races. But again, a governor's race is in the state, while the Senate race is one that oftentimes has more national sort of salience. And again, it's a question of who may have control of the Senate come January. As well as the state house, and that may make a difference, you know, inside Wisconsin and outside Wisconsin. So it's sort of both ways. And both elections will probably have a lot of national attention, I would think.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. She was with us to talk about record levels of outside spending early on in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race this year. Right now, Gemma Tarlak is back with us for a look at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science, including male birth control, the quest for new non-addictive pain relievers, and a continent splitting apart at the seams. Possibly. Gemma is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello and happy science to you.
Well, yeah, to you too. And let's start, Gemma, by talking about birth control. And when we think about birth control for men, there are a lot fewer options than there are for women. Why is that?
Well, it's a number of reasons. But, you know, one of the things is, I mean, well, men basically have the choice between a condom or a vasectomy, whereas women have all different kinds of options in terms of everything from surgery to oral medications and everything in between. And part of that is it can be very dangerous for a woman to be pregnant. So a lot of times doctors are looking for other ways, researchers are looking for other ways to make sure that women can have better control over their reproduction. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, with guys don't face that same issue. So basically, a lot of it has just been led by the need, where the need is greatest. But there are some other factors as well, in that several trials of several different potential male contraceptives have run into all different kinds of difficulties.
And the first one actually detailed in a Discover Magazine article involves taking a really, really deadly poison and using it as a male birth control after tweaking it a bit. But, you know, that tell us about that one. It seems a little disturbing
sure.
At first blush.
Sure. Well, I want to back up a little bit because that particular approach, it involves a poison called Huabane, and that particular approach has not advanced to human trials yet. So they haven't tried it in any people yet. So don't worry, guys. It's not an issue. But it has a really fascinating history to it because Huabane is actually a substance that is used in some areas of Africa, especially in the East. It's used as a poison because in its natural form, it's kind of a heart-stopping compound. And it works by disrupting a critical process that the cells exchange material. It's basically a way that the cells nourish themselves and keep going. And this protein, this compound, disturbs that process in heart cell muscles. And so the researchers took this compound and they engineered it. They just tweaked it a little bit so that it's not going to stop your heart, but it does disrupt that critical protein in sperm instead. And it's very early in the research. I want to stress that we are years and years and years away from human trials if they ever happen. But so far, it looks pretty promising in the lab in terms of just stopping sperm.
Can you talk about some of the other male contraceptive methods that are maybe in the works and some of the challenges they face?
Sure. Well, you know, there is a lot of work looking at testosterone and how a potential gel that's actually entering a very large-scale human trial this summer, a testosterone-based gel, might work. Kind of similar idea to the way oral contraceptives work for women, but there are a lot of other compounds out there that are being tested or have been tested that have nothing to do with testosterone and other sex hormones. And there are things, for example, there's one compound that successfully disrupts and stops production of an acid that is critical in sperm production. So that sounds really good. That sounds super great. But if you have this compound in your system and you drink alcohol, it's going to make you super, super sick. So there are lots of things where the compound looks really good, the method looks really good, and then they get to a certain point in the research and they realize, oh, there's this problem. You know, one of the problems, for example, with a lot of the testosterone potential contraceptives that have been tried is that they only work on 8 or 9 out of 10 men. And that becomes an issue, obviously, because if you're going to be taking this, you want a failure rate. You want a failure rate that's smaller than the average condom use, which is at about 90%. I should say a 10% failure rate, not a 90% failure rate. But all different approaches, and it's really an interesting field that I think is just in the past couple of years taking off, just in terms of people looking for better alternatives for men.
But we shouldn't be looking for these coming to a doctor's office near us in the short term future, right?
Yeah, probably they're all at least a few years off. Some of them, for example, that large-scale testosterone gel study that I mentioned that's underway, this is the at least the second human trial of this. It's the first large-scale one. And if those results are promising, then you could expect that to gain even more momentum and probably be the first thing on the market. But again, a lot of hurdles to jump.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the most interesting stories in the world of science. Let's turn to another effort to develop a medicine, Gemma. We've got this opioid addiction problem. We talk about it a lot on the show. And the medical community is trying to figure out pain-relieving medications, still sometimes based on opioid drugs, that would not have the addictive potential. Talk about the importance, first of all, of coming up with something like this.
Yeah, well, first I want to say this is opioid addiction and opioid overdose deaths in our country and in other countries as well. It's such a huge issue right now, and it's also an extremely complex issue. So, but when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's just absolutely, it takes your breath away. In 2016, more than 42,000 people just in America died because of opioid overdose, and at least 2 million Americans are dealing with opioid prescription opioid addiction. I want to stress prescription because there's also the street drugs as well. And, you know, they estimate that of the people prescribed opioids for chronic pain, about a quarter of them, a quarter to a third, are going to misuse them. So it is a huge issue that is touching just millions of people. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how to address it politically and socioeconomically and all those factors. But our contributing editor, Jonathan Keats, went to the researchers who are on the front lines of figuring out, as they put it, how to make an opioid that kills the pain without killing the patient. And they really have to start from scratch and create these brand new approaches to pain killing. So it's very exciting, and there's been some very, very cool developments, but we're still a ways off. Like with male contraception, we're still a ways off from having the drug on the shelf that's going to help people with chronic pain without creating all these horrible problems with addiction.
And it gets really complicated because it turns out pain and how we feel pain is really complicated, right? Can you talk a little bit about the science between pain and how these opioid medications work?
Sure, sure. And I want to stress that the approaches that we cover in the magazine, they're all very different approaches. But basically, your body is full of opioid receptors. For a long time, researchers thought that only the brain and central nervous system had these opioid receptors. But a few decades ago, and we talked to one of the researchers who discovered this, we found out that there are all these peripheral opioid receptors that are outside of the brain. And this particular research, Christoph Stein, he actually figured out a way that inflammation plays a role. Like if you break your leg, let's say, the tissue around that break is going to get super inflamed, and the opioid receptors, the peripheral opioid receptors around that leg, are going to register that inflammation. So he is looking at developing an opioid alternative that would only target areas that have that level of inflammation. So the opioid would go to work and would kill the pain you have because you just broke your leg, but it wouldn't even get into your brain. It would stay out of your brain because it only works in areas where the acidity is actually higher than the natural acidity you find in the brain. So that's, for example, and I just want to stress that I have super simplified some very complicated work, but Jonathan breaks it down really well in our cover story, this issue, if you're interested in the topic. And that's just one approach. Again, using inflammation as a kind of roadmap for the painkiller, like, hey, go over here, don't go there to the brain. But, you know, sometimes painkillers do get to the brain, and that's why another scientist is working on looking at how the release of dopamine in the brain by an opioid can create this cascade effect and lead to addiction and other issues. And, you know, dopamine, I'm sure folks know that it's a neurotransmitter and that it basically helps the neurons talk to each other. And one of the things dopamine does is it reinforces behavior. It's kind of the reward system of the brain. And what happens with opioids is they hijack that natural reward system and really lead the brain to just crave more and more and more and more. And that's one of the one of the issues with addiction. So basically, this researcher, Edward Bilski, is really looking at how we can disrupt that dopamine function in terms of hijacking the reward system, but without disrupting all the other things dopamine does, because it does a lot of things. In addition to helping the neurons talk to each other, it's involved in a lot of different just physiological crucial functions. So he's looking at a way to kind of stop the hijacking and let dopamine do the things that it needs to do without letting the opioids kind of force the person into addiction. So that's another really exciting angle.
And I want to switch gears for our last minute or so. Gemma, continental drift and the formation of new continents, we think that happens over tens of thousands of years, and it does, but we're seeing signs of it maybe happening in Africa in real time.
Well, yeah, you know, we've known for years, for ever since pretty much plate tectonics was a thing, for at least the last half century, we've known that the African Rift Valley, which is basically between the Red Sea and Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, down into Kenya, we've known that it's splitting apart. The continent is kind of being pulled apart by the underlying plate tectonics. And for a long time, that was the textbook. Hey, it's splitting apart. But now geologists are realizing, wait a minute, it's not splitting apart the way we thought it was. And that may mean that it's not actually going to split apart, that it may actually kind of heal itself. So our writer followed a geologist around, and she's tracking this in field stations. And it's fascinating, and it's just a really beautiful part of the continent of Africa as well. So there's a lot of just really beautiful visuals and wonderful people in the story.
And briefly, Gemma, this may have happened from Lake Superior to Kansas in the distant past, right? It looked like it was going to break apart. It kind of welded itself back together.
Yeah, absolutely. That rift, in fact, you can see it even in parts of Wisconsin. There are little bits of it left, but it basically looked like, if you can imagine North America just getting ripped apart right across the middle, it looked like that was going to happen, but then it stopped. And that is something geologists have always struggled to understand, and they may actually be able to use what's happening in Africa now to inform their understanding of what happened billions of years ago right here in our backyard.
Good place to leave it. Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us once a month with some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. There's more to come here on Central Time. First, many legendary writers of the past are also known as legendary drinkers. Hunter S. Thompson, Raymond Carver, Charles Jackson, Carson McCullers, William Faulkner, the list goes on and on. A lot of those writers also held a belief that their drinking somehow fueled their creativity and interestingness. But can the recovery story and the sobriety story be just as interesting? Leslie Jameson teaches at the Columbia University Master of Fine Arts program, where she directs the nonfiction concentration. Her latest book is The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Leslie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we see addiction presented often in pop culture, in literature, and elsewhere. And the drama, or sometimes it's even played for laughs, is on the addiction side of things, and the recovery isn't always seen as exciting a story. And you're taking a stab at changing that, right?
Yeah, well, I wanted to both write a version of my own addiction and recovery story in which I could try to see if the sobriety part of that story, the recovery part of that story, could be as compelling as the story of kind of falling apart in the first place. And I also wanted to look at other writers and artists who had made art from their addictions and to see what kind of creativity they had found in sobriety and what kinds of stories they had tried to tell about recovery as well.
And this is a memoir because it's your story, but it is also about those other writers and about the people you went through recovery with in AA meetings and elsewhere. Did you plan from the start to have this be more than just Leslie's story of recovery?
Absolutely. I knew from the very beginning that I wanted to create a book that functions more like a chorus of stories than simply holding my own. And the reasons for that, well, one reason was that part of what I had found extraordinary about recovery was the way that it had healed me, in part by through the act of listening to other people's stories. And so I wanted the book to kind of enact that on a structural level, that kind of opening outward to include the stories of other people. And then the question was, well, how and where was I going to find those stories? And so part of that came from kind of literary criticism and spending about 5 years digging through archives of various writers who had gotten sober or tried to get sober. And then part of it came through seeking out as a journalist the stories of other kind of quote-unquote ordinary people in recovery who were generous enough to sort of allow me to use their stories as part of the book as well. And I put ordinary in quotes because I kind of believe in every ordinary life as holding kind of infinite interest and infinite insight if you just look at it hard enough.
And with creative people in particular, is there often that fear that, am I going to be able to do the creative stuff that I do without the alcohol or whatever the addiction is?
Absolutely. I mean, there's over and over again with the writers I was looking at, writers like John Berryman, Raymond Carver, even singers like Billie Holiday or Amy Winehouse. Over and over, I would see articulations with precisely that fear. John Berryman said in one of his dream songs, you know, something can be said for sobriety, but very little. But later on in his life came to feel that it was a delusion that he had to attack, the idea that his art depended on his drinking. Somebody like Dennis Johnson, who passed away just last year, said that, you know, he was deeply afraid that getting sober would destroy his creativity, but that actually what he found in sobriety was that he was able to write so much more. And in fact, some of my favorite things that he's written are stories of recovery and what it looks like for people to find community and getting better.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own story of alcohol addiction and sobriety?
Yeah. So for me, I think, you know, there are many places where you could look at my addiction as coming back to you. Certainly there's a lot of drinking in my family and a history of mental illness in my family, but I experienced drinking at first as like a deep relief from this kind of like paralyzing shyness and this sense of, you know, never quite deserving to be in a room or be in a relationship, and that booze was sort of what released me from that like crippling self-consciousness. And, you know, ultimately, like, my drinking story is much less dramatic than some, but for me what I really started to feel was that my whole world started to constrict and to become about that horizon, 6 p.m., 5 p.m., 4 p.m., whenever I was going to get that first drink. I started to see the ways that not only was it affecting my health, but it was affecting, you know, my relationship with a wonderful man that I lived with, you know, these kind of toxic fights we would have, waking up. I remember at one point finding a little stack of apology notes that I had left for him after various fights, saying, well, I'm sorry that I said this, I'm sorry that I said that, and something about that stack of notes was like, right, there's a real price here. And so I ended up getting sober in my late 20s, and I tried a few different times before it finally stuck, and I write about that too. I think it's important to tell the kind of messier version of the recovery story rather than pretending that it's cleaner, neater than it is. But I really ended up finding in fellowship and in 12-step recovery, not just relief from this dependence on booze, but a sense of community and a sense of sort of the intense camaraderie of sharing stories with others.
Talking to Leslie Jamison about her new book, The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Leslie, let's talk about the power of storytelling. It's a theme that comes up again and again in your book. Writers, people in AA, they're in a way using storytelling to create a new character, a character of them without the alcohol in this case. Can you talk about the power of narrative?
Absolutely. So I had, you know, spent a lot of time in literary worlds where people were very committed to the practice of storytelling, but almost always with this belief that we had to try to tell the most beautiful stories we could and the most original stories we could to try to tell a story that had never been told before. And I was really struck in recovery by the way in which the imperative was almost the opposite. Like, you were supposed to tell a story that had already been told and that would be told again. The idea that your story was something shared rather than something original wasn't a damning thing. It was a saving thing. And so I really explore that in the book, how telling your own story can be an offering to the other people in the room, and how showing up and listening to other people's stories can be this deliverance from that kind of like claustrophobic storage room of the self. And as you said, you know, in a way you're writing a story in which you're creating yourself as a new character, a sober version of yourself.
I read a list earlier of men, famous men who were hard drinking writers. And that's almost like a stock character, and it's kind of celebrated, the guy pounding down drinks, finding deeper truths through it. How about women? Why aren't there stories like that? Why are men and women in addiction treated differently?
It's a great question, and one of the things that I explore in the book, or one of the ideas that I explore in the book, is how different addictions get narrated differently. So, as you say, we have this kind of available archetypal character of the drunk male rogue genius. And I look at how female drunks often get perceived in different ways. They get perceived as unseemly, melodramatic, self-indulgent. And I think a lot of that has to do with the different caregiving expectations we bring to women, that we expect women to be caregivers. And so when a woman is getting drunk, she's often failing at that task of caregiving. She's being a bad mom. She's selfishly sort of looking inward rather than taking care of someone else. And, you know, and you can even see that in the media construction of the character of the crack mother in the late 80s, right, who was seen not as a victim, not as somebody who is suffering, but as somebody who is failing to be the right kind of mother. And I also look at the ways that not just gender, but race and class shape how some addictions get narrated in terms of suffering and other addictions get narrated as crimes.
Yeah, talk about that a little more, because we have this opioid epidemic going on now, and there's definitely more of a, I think it's fair to say, more of a compassionate approach, help people. They're dealing with a disease where, you, as you mentioned, with the crack epidemic of the 80s on into the 90s, it was a personality flaw, a legal issue, a law and order issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a deep, deep history, not just with the crack epidemic in the 80s, but preceding that, there's a deep history in America of using the construction of addiction, of an addiction epidemic, to scapegoat a marginalized population. So it happened with Chinese immigrant communities and opium. It happened with Hispanic immigrant communities and marijuana in the 30s. It happened with African Americans in the South and cocaine in the early 20th century, and happened with rural white populations and the meth epidemic. These ways that addicts are seen as violators of the social contract, people who need to be held accountable for their crimes rather than people who are suffering. And one of the things I'm writing about in the book is that, you know, that's about storytelling as well. What stories are we telling about those addictions? And that those stories have real consequences in the social imagination and in public policy. So, you know, the extremely punitive drug legislation that was passed in the 1950s, or again under Reagan in the 1980s, you know, really depended on certain kinds of storytelling practices. And I think hopefully we are gradually moving towards storytelling practices that emphasize addiction as a state of suffering and can really look toward treatment as not just the most humane, but the most effective way of grappling with the problem of addiction.
We're talking to Leslie Jamison. She's the author of The Empathy Exams, and her latest book is The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like we need to pay more attention to stories of recovery and sobriety? If that is your story, how do you tell that story? How do you talk about addiction and recovery, about yourself or someone in your family? And do you feel like our culture pushes the idea that creativity and drug or alcohol use go together for some reason? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Writer Leslie Jamison is with us. Her new book is The Recovering: Intoxication and Its Aftermath. She shares her personal experience with alcoholism and recovery and digs into the culture of drinking and creativity and the stories we tell and don't tell about recovery. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do some of your favorite writers or other creative types also have a history of addiction? How does that affect the way you think about them? And do you have a personal experience, a personal story about addiction in your life and recovery? And how do you tell that story to other people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. Before we go to our callers, Leslie, you mentioned earlier that a recovery is messier than we think about it sometimes. I think we think of the story of this arc of down, suffering, addiction, recovery, happy ending, and it's just not that simple. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have a version of the recovery story that kind of owes its roots to a much older story, the conversion story, where things get bad. At some point, they get bad enough, and then things get better, and they stay better. But I think as anybody who's struggled with addiction or been close to somebody who struggles with addiction knows, it's rarely that simple. So often the story of addiction looks much more like a cycle of trying to get sober, maybe staying sober for a while, relapsing, kind of coming back into familiar patterns that can be very frustrating for the person dealing with them or people who care about them. You know, I think it's important to make room for the ways in which the story isn't always a neat or immediate resolution. And also, you know, part of why the book is called The Recovering rather than just The Recovered or Recovery is to suggest that it's a very ongoing process. It's not a story that ever has an ending. It's a story that kind of, you know, sobriety keeps going day by day rather than ever being resolved or absolute.
Yeah, that reminds me, one of the authors you wrote about, I can't remember which one, was working on a book, I think till the end of his life, on recovery, and he had, at the end of it, sort of written on a note card or something, but never really completed that in all of his life.
Yeah, it was John Berryman.
Right.
Who I mentioned earlier, who said, you know, something has been said for sobriety, but very little, and he did, by the end of his life, was trying to write a novel from recovery and about recovery called Recovery, but he never finished that book, and I found it really moving to see when I researched in his archives to see these note cards where he had written possible endings for the book, but it was as if he couldn't quite bring himself to imagine how the book ended, and in his own life, he really struggled to stay sober and eventually relapsed after his longest stretch of sobriety and then committed suicide, and so it was as if he could also not quite write a story for himself of sobriety to live into.
And you're well into recovering yourself, but do you feel like you're ever going to feel like there's a point in your life where you're done?
No, I mean, it's important for me to think about my own recovery as ongoing and sort of renewed day by day. I mean, I think that's why many people live by the adage one day at a time, and it's quite useful in that sense of sort of not making guarantees about the long-term future, but just saying, you know, we wake up and we show up to sobriety on a daily basis. And I try to stay humble in that way.
I want to bring on a caller now. We'll go to Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call. I hesitated whether I was going to call, but I used to volunteer in drug and alcohol treatment. And over the years, I've learned from talking with many people who struggle with this that it really is a daily choice, and that choice is very existential and it's very serious, and you can throw a lot of words at it, but it really is a battle between good and evil. And when people take responsibility for that, that is a never-ending choice. And you get on the slippery slope, and you show signs of relapse and things like that. You need support. You need other people who see what you don't see in yourself. And that's the importance of reaching out.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And Leslie, again, you talk about in the book, your recovery in a lot of ways isn't just your recovery. It's connected to these other writers, the other people in AA and other people who have been through this through history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think major parts of what Jeff said when he called in rang true, particularly this idea of the necessity of getting support from other people. And I think that beautifully articulated thought that sometimes you need other people to see in you what you can't quite see in yourself. So I absolutely believe that that's part of what makes community necessary. I mean, I think the language of good and evil can sometimes be deployed as a sort of punitive language. This idea that you know, where do you locate the source of that evil? And in that sense, I think it can slide into or verge into vilifying addicts in a way that I think both misrecognizes the ways in which addiction is a disease and one that some people are kind of biologically primed for, but can also obstruct the process of getting better.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Leslie Jamison, author of The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Back to your calls. Tyler is on the line in Milwaukee. Tyler, hi.
Hi, this is Tyler.
What did you want to tell us about?
Hey, man, I've been using since I was 12 years old, started with cigarettes and weed and stuff, and, you know, I've dabbled in this and that throughout my whole life, and now I'm about to turn 28, and I spent 10 years on the road from age 18 to 28, driving around the country, and even just smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee alone and missing a lot of nights of sleep, along with a lot of partying, I didn't really realize what I was doing to myself and others this whole time. And I've gotten to really high points, but there's a lot of cheap thrills, I realized. And as of even the last week here, came to a lot of realizations in my just week of sobriety. And I'm, like she was saying, it's kind of, it's an ongoing thing, man. And now I'm about to be 28 years old, and I feel like I got the rest of my life to work on this.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing that, and good luck to you on the road as a musician there and just now at 28, trying to turn things around. Leslie, what are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for calling in, and you know, all I can say is I hear you. I think it is ongoing. I think you know, I think it's important to recognize that there are sometimes highs as well as lows in the experience of addiction, and then if we're not honest about the appeal of you know, booze and drugs, and you know, it's not being real to pretend like there aren't, you know, often real experiences of like happiness and bliss that get bound up in substances. And I think it's great to be honest about that, and also great to be honest about, you know, sort of what you want life to hold next. So I just wish you the best of luck.
Thanks a lot for that call. And again, good luck. As we start to wrap up, Leslie, I think there's always another generation of people coming into especially creative lines who think that alcohol or heroin or you name it is part of the persona, part of the creative process. What would you say to them early on so they don't have to, maybe they don't have to end up in recovery at all?
Yeah. Well, what's coming to mind is actually a quote from Billie Holiday, who I write about a bit in the book, but, you know, where one of the things that Billie Holiday told the world and told, like, people who were close to her was, you know, that they might believe that the junk was part of what made her the singer that she was, but that, you know, it really didn't do her any good, and it certainly wasn't the place where her art came from. So, you know, has plenty of beautiful art been written out of lives that were people who were struggling with addiction? Of course. It's not an unequivocal obstacle, but there's also plenty of beauty that can come from states of recovery as well.
We'll leave it there. Leslie, thanks a lot for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Leslie Jamison. She teaches at the Columbia University Master of Fine Arts program, where she directs the nonfiction concentration. She's the author of the book, The Empathy Exams, and she joined us to talk about her latest book. It's called The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. She shares her own personal story, but also the story of writers and others in the creative world dealing with addiction and the people she met along the way in recovery groups around the country and around the world. Tweet us at Central Time WPR if you have something to share yourself. I found an interesting resource for people interested in sound, and we're in the radio world. We like sound. It's called Conserve the Sound. It preserves audio of technologies that are obsolete or on their way to being obsolete. Here's a quote from their website. Conserve the Sound is an online museum for vanishing and endangered sounds, the sound of a dial telephone, a Walkman, an analog typewriter, a payphone, a 56K modem, nuclear power plant, even a cell phone keypad are partially already gone or about to disappear from our daily life. So, using some of their resources there, here is a sound quiz for you using some of their endangered sounds. You could play along at home or in your car. There is no prize. All right, let's listen to the first sound. All right, if I didn't know what that one was, I would think it was some kind of kid's toy. It is not. It is a push-button phone. So in that era between the dial phones and those really, you know, quieter button phones, that was one of those where you really had to crank that button down. So if you said push-button phone, we will give you points for that. Again, no prizes. Here's our next entry. I don't think there's any way you're going to get that. Think of your power windows. No, that is the crank window from a car. One more. Just time for that. Yes, it's rolling up the cassette tape with a pencil. Bonus points if you said it was a Brahms cassette. Great sounds here on Central Time.